Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, my attempt to put real positive news out there in the world about how humans are weird and smart, while I enjoy the most perfect example of our human ingenuity, the beverage known as beer. So, yeah, I totally disappeared, but I am back from an unexpected but much-needed break. Watched the Olympics, started moving a certain paper-making studio to some spacious new digs, you know, getting some unavoidable life stuff done. I noticed this is episode number 111, and I have a few I-related stories, so I'm going to call this episode I. It was either that or the eyes have it. Don't hit me. I could also have gone with Attack of the Eye Creatures. Look it up. Anyway, to keep with the eye theme, I am overriding the random beer selection gizmo, the randomizer, and have chosen for myself a special IPA. Get it? Don't hit me. I've got Riverbend Brewing Company's Mango Fluff Yourself Mango Milkshake IPA, a 7% ABV American IPA with mango added. I feel like I've described what an IPA is about a million times already, so let's do it again. An IPA is an India Pale Ale, so named because in order for the British to ensure their beer survived the long voyage between Great Britain and India in the 1800s, they loaded up their pale ales with hops, increasing the bitterness and creating this distinct style. An American IPA takes the already high bitterness and alcohol content and, you guessed it, supersizes it. And this one has mango added. Oh, mango. Let's open this can up, but first I need to transition to the beer mic. Well, it definitely smells a bit like mango and milk. That's good. And it's a hazy orangish color with a pale white head. Let's just dive in. Oh, mango. It's like going to Jamba Juice or Orange Julius. That is delicious. A little tiny bit of bitterness, but that accentuates the bitterness of like a rind kind of taste in it. You know, like when you have an orange and the orange peel is a little bitter. I think the mango is about the same. So that was Mango Fluff Yourself. I'm not going to remark on that at all. Hey, ever heard of Verily? It's an Alphabet subsidiary, which means it's part of Google, and they are, quote, focused on using technology to better understand health, as well as prevent, detect, and manage disease. Their mission is to bring together technology and life sciences to uncover new truths about health and disease. Quite a noble effort. The Verge reports that Verily has developed a system that can predict heart disease by simply gazing into your eyes. The system was detailed in a paper published in, you guessed it, the Nature Journal subsidiary Biomedical Engineering. In case you were unawares, the rear interior of the eye, called the fundus, is full of blood vessels. The study of these blood vessels via camera and microscope by doctors can infer aspects of the body's health, blood pressure, age, and if they smoke, all of which are predictors of overall cardiovascular health, or lack thereof. Verily trained an AI to be able to identify those aspects by having it analyze a medical dataset made up from almost 300,000 patients' records, which included eye scans. Using deep learning, the AI's neural network was able to identify patterns related to cardiovascular health to aspects present in the eye scans. When provided with images of retinal scans in groups of two, one from a patient that had suffered a cardiovascular event 5 years previous, and one from a patient who hadn't, the system correctly deduced which scan had cardiovascular issues 70% of the time. Now, the current standard for determining cardiovascular risk, called the SCORE method, requires a blood test, and is accurate up to 72% of the time. So it sounds like this eye system is a winner. No more jabs. The success of this system is a lot more exciting than having a less invasive alternative to cardiovascular health assessment, though. It shows that it is possible to find new ways of algorithmically analyzing existing medical data to gain more information. That means that, hopefully, given a large enough trove of medical data, AI can, quote, create entirely new medical insight without human direction. Neat. Sounds a little bit like a Fallout-style autodoc might be on the horizon, at least for diagnoses. Don't really want that operating on me. Self-driving cars! They're coming. The majority of the self-driving cars out there today utilize a system of sensors, cameras, and LiDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging, as its eyes. According to Engadget, Israeli startup Adasky thinks that's all well and good, but maybe thermal imaging could be a valuable addition to that vision system. Their special camera collects passive thermal information from the world in its view, converts it into high-resolution video, and feeds that into its computer vision system. From there, the AI determines if the shapes are cars, trucks, people, animals, aspects of the road, trees, bicycles, motorcycles, birds. You get the idea. It's the same way the LiDAR systems work. Collect visual information and have a central system parse what thing is what. But the advantage of the thermal system is the thermal aspect itself. Most things a self-driving car would like to not hit generate heat. Vehicles and living things. If the vision system can't quite figure out if that thing in the road is a plastic bag floating in the wind or a chicken crossing the road, you've got a potential sticky problem. And it's not just identifying living things that thermal vision could assist self-driving cars with. It can also see through fog, dust, and direct sunlight, all things LiDAR and cameras have a hard time with, and it can even potentially see black ice on the road ahead and avoid it. That's nearly impossible for our weak human eyes. So if thermal vision is such a great add-on, why aren't more companies developing self-driving cars taking advantage of it? Well, one, it's another sensor being added to an already expensive product, and two, it vastly increases the amount of data the vehicle's computer systems have to process, meaning faster and more expensive computers, meaning an even higher price. However, if everyone starts doing it, then the price overall will drop, and I could legally drink in the car on long road trips. All thanks to computer eyes! It's no big secret that I like having smart devices on my very person, recording all sorts of data. I wear Misfit Shine at night to record my sleep, and I wear a Huawei Watch 2 for pulse and step tracking. I also like to wear wristbands as a questionable fashion choice, but I know that some people, like my wife, don't like wearing anything on their wrists regularly. I do think simple health tracking is useful, but what can people do if they don't want Fitbits and smartwatches shackled to their wrists? How about you wear your fitness tracker on your face? Huh? Digital Trends reports that VSP Global, the vision insurance company, has revealed The Level, a pair of health tracking eyeglass frames, after a year-long beta test. VSP explains their decision to put all this right in your face, quote, because Level is centered on your body's axis. Our engineers have designed a step count model that accurately tracks purposeful steps and eliminates non-step movements. These are smart glasses, in only the most basic sense. There is no Google Glass-like screen to display information. It simply sends the data collected by its sensors to your smartphone. Inside the frames of the very normal-looking glasses in the left temple is a magnetometer, an accelerometer, a gyroscope, a Bluetooth transmitter receiver, and a small battery, all residing in the left arm, and the battery lasts up to 5 days at a time and recharges in 30 minutes with a regular micro-USB cable. Really, you couldn't do USB-C? The Level software not only records your daily steps, it also offers to sync your data with the VSP's Eyes of Hope initiative. If wearers opt into the initiative and complete daily activity goals, they gain points. Once they reach 50 points, VSP will give someone in need a comprehensive eye exam and eyewear completely free. That's really cool. Because these are actual real eyeglass frames, you would need to visit an optometrist to get a pair, and they don't come cheap. They will cost $270, but if you have VSP insurance, that price can come down a little. The frames begin their rollout in March, initially only being available in Sacramento, California. Then they move into 5 more markets in April: Seattle, Washington, Denver, Colorado, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon. Hey, that's where I live! If I didn't hate wearing glasses so much, I'd go for a pair. I wear contacts because I am vain. Hey, at the top of the show, I mentioned I was helping a certain papermaking studio move to a fancy new location. I was talking about Pulp & Deckel. Heard of it? Were you aware that this show's sponsor is Pulp & Deckel, which is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio? It's true. And Pulp & Deckel's mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com! Gets me so excited. That is PulpandDeckle.com. Hey, and if you mention I'll have a beer and talk, we might give you something special. That's a fridge in the new space. That fridge might contain beer. Quick, how do you think Americans would react to proof of life from beyond this planet? If you've watched a lot of sci-fi like I have, the answer is probably panic and violence. Well, I have some good news. Slash Gear reports that a study was recently published in Frontiers in Psychology that shows Americans just might react positively to the news of extraterrestrial life being discovered. The researchers behind the study were trying to determine the potential psychological impact that the discovery of extraterrestrial life would have on humans. The results of three empirical studies that used linguistic inquiry and word count rest analyses were detailed in the study. Basically, those three studies analyzed the words used by the subjects when asked to describe how they believe they would respond to an announcement about the discovery of alien life, as well as how they felt humanity itself would respond. Language analysis of the responses showed more positive words being used than negative ones, with the overall results being largely positive. Now, this study was asking specifically about how people would react to news of microbial alien life being discovered, not just seeing news of aliens landing on the lawn in front of the Washington Monument. This may be why the expected panic and violence reaction didn't come out on top, but hey, maybe humans can be rational when their worldview is altered forever. Yeah, and I'm a Chinese jet pilot. Anyway, the study also made an interesting observation, which I shall read here. It is also noteworthy that we did not observe much variation in responses as a function of personality traits, disease avoidance, political orientation, or demographic factors such as income or ethnicity. One potential interpretation is that there may be a fair amount of homogeneity in reactions to extraterrestrial life, and that the findings of the current study may be broadly generalizable. Generalizable, that's a fantastic word. Slash Gear points out that the research is focused on specifically United States Americans, so maybe Central and Southern Americans and Canadians and Europeans would react differently. Who knows? All I know is I, for one, would welcome our new alien overlords, be they microbial or human-sized or larger. Hey, ever notice how music you really got into during your teen years has really stuck with you? Assuming you're out of your teen years, of course. Well, you are not alone. The Verge reports that, according to a New York Times analysis of Spotify data, the music you listen to as a teenager affects your musical taste as you grow into an adult. The New York Times took data supplied by Spotify about how frequently every song is listened to by men and women, broken down by their age. Then, the Billboard Top Song charts from 1960 to the year 2000 were applied to the age/playback dataset to see how old fans of those songs today were when those songs first came out. It turns out, men form their musical tastes between the ages of 13 to 16 and women between the ages of 11 and 14. Seth Stevens Davidowitz, the author of the New York Times piece, used Radiohead's song Creep as an example. That's a fantastic example. Creep is the 164th most popular song among 38-year-old men currently, meaning that they were 14 years old when Creep was first released in 1993, and Creep isn't even in the top 300 songs for those born a decade earlier or later. The Cure's Just Like Heaven, released in 1987, is popular with women who are currently age 41, meaning they were 11 years old when Just Like Heaven was just released, and this age range correlates across the years in respect to the listeners' ages. Men like music that was popular when they were 13 to 16, and women like music that was popular when they were 11 to 14. It's pretty close for me, even though according to this I should have a fondness for late 80s and early 90s music, and I tend to be in the mid to late 90s, just personal preference. My wife, although, does actually exactly fit in with the 11 to 14 range, too. Interesting. My love of late 90s alternative could actually be explained by the fact that I was a late music consumer bloomer. I listened to a lot of film scores in my preteen years, because I'm weird, if you haven't noticed already. Gizmodo reports that scientists in Australia scanned the brains of drunk men. That's the story. Okay, there's a little bit more to that. The scans were performed as part of an effort to discover why it seems like people tend to get meaner as they get drunk, and the results were published in the journal Cognitive, Affective, and Behavioral Neuroscience. Scientists at the University of New South Wales took high-quality fMRI brain scans and revealed that the part of the brain responsible for planning, personality, and social behavior moderation effectively takes a nap while you're getting your drink on. Previous research had already determined the prefrontal cortex was responsible for heightened aggression while drinking, but lead researcher Thomas Denson wanted to take a look at what was going on while it was going on. His team gathered 50 healthy men between the ages of 18 to 30 without telling them alcohol would be part of the study. Volunteers who revealed they had pre-existing alcohol problems, reported poor physical or mental health, were on medication that could not be combined with alcohol, didn't like alcohol, and didn't drink three or more times a month, were released from the study. Each surviving volunteer were given two drinks, either a non-alcoholic placebo or vodka. They were then tasked with playing a competitive reaction time game while having their brain scanned in an fMRI machine. The game was designed to frustrate. The winner of each round is allowed to send a blast of an, quote, unpleasant noise to the loser, and also control the volume of that unpleasant noise. As time goes on, the game takes on a retaliatory aspect, which, as you can imagine, can get a little out of hand, especially if they've been drinking. The trick was on the volunteers, however. They were told they were competing against other volunteers, but were actually competing with two computers. While this game was going on, the researchers were watching in real time what areas of the brain were active and could compare that data between the vodka group and the placebo group's actions. When the vodka volunteers were provoked during the game, no unusual neural activity was recorded, but when they chose to act aggressively, there was an immediate discernible drop in prefrontal cortex activity. Yes, the area of the brain normally responsible for moderating social behavior took a brief holiday at the exact moment it was needed most. Gizmodo spoke to Brian M. Quigley, an addictions expert at the University of Buffalo SUNY, who was not involved with the study, and he had this to say about the results. The findings of the study add support to theories regarding alcohol-related aggression that have proposed alcohol would have effects on the brain structures identified in this study, especially the prefrontal cortex. Alcohol affects decision-making by decreasing one's attention to inhibitory cues, making one act more impulsive or immediately responsive to what is right in front of them, a process known as alcohol myopia. A good example of this myopia is a drunk person accidentally being bumped by someone else. They fixate on the immediate moment and respond without processing the context or consequences of lashing out. Now, Quigley points out that not everyone who drinks gets aggressive, and not all people who are aggressive drink. Booze simply lowers a person's threshold for becoming aggressive. Alcohol also causes one to fixate on immediate environmental cues, so if you're having a beer in a nice chill bar, you're going to tend to be pretty relaxed. And if you're at some club on Pico called Technor, you might get a little aggressive if a large Austrian man pushes you across the dance floor. For the record, I prefer drinking in the nice chill bar. Or at home. Or in the I'll Have a Beer and Talk bunker. Alright, I am going to close out this vaguely eye-themed episode with a story about animal eyes. Specifically, fish eyes. Eyes that kind of act like flashlights. Gizmodo informed me that new research published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal shows that Tryptarygon delicae, which I know I just totally mangled that, also known as a triple fin, it's a fish, has a special trick in its eyes. The triple fin utilizes a form of active sensing called photolocation, in which reflected light is used to probe the environment. Photolocation is rare in vertebrates. They use built-in chemiluminescent searchlights, which are specialized light organs located next to the pupils. As sunlight beams down from above the water, the light organs reflect the light in a sideways direction, improving vision under low light. Fish don't have any control over this effect. It's kind of a neat side effect produced, and likely enhanced, by the powers of evolution. It's real. Before discovering that triple fin uses photolocation, only three other examples of creatures using photolocation were known. Deep sea dragonfish, lanternfishes, and flashlight fishes. That's flashlight fishes, not fleshlight fishes. Can't believe I just went there. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Triple fin can actually control when their eyes light up and when they need them to, in an action called controlled iris radiance. The triple fin calls its home in an area from the East Atlantic Ocean through the West Mediterranean Sea and grow 2 to 3 inches long. They tend to hang out motionless most of the time, as we all really wish we could too, occasionally hopping to a new location in a quick movement, and when they spot some delicious prey, they slowly creep up on it before making a quick strike. It's been observed that the triple fish alternate the color of their eyes between red and blue by rotating and tilting their eyes while stalking prey, which led marine biologists to suspect that they were using photolocation. The research team wanted to determine if the red and blue glows emanating from the triple fin's eyes were actively being turned on and off, and not just the side effect of light and the ambient background color of its environment. They gazed into the triple fin's eyes and focused on its ocular sparks, a bright spot just below the pupil in the iris. When triple fin made small, deliberate eye movements, the eye glow would activate or deactivate instantly. In tests performed in tanks at a Tübingen University lab, the blue light sparks fired more frequently against red backgrounds, and vice versa, especially when prey were around. By using blue light against red backgrounds and red light against blue backgrounds, the triple fin were actively working to maximize the contrast between the light reflected onto the prey and the background, and were able to light up an area about 2 inches in front of them. The researchers concluded their study with this statement. We conclude that iris radiance through ocular sparks in T. delisi is not a side effect of eye movement, but adaptively modulated in response to the context under which prey are detected. Rhinestone eyes. They're like factories far away. Hey, if you watched the Olympics all last week like my wife and I did, you know this song is already stuck in your head. Everyone, did you know that this show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckel, but that it's also supported by loyal listeners just like you? If you enjoy the show, want to join in on the fun, I've got 3 choices for you. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. I actively edit and produce this show. I co-host, edit, and produce the Many Happy Returns podcast. And I edit the Paper Talk podcast. Edit all the things. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckel.com. That is gary@pulpanddeckel.com. Rates are reasonable. And here's an open podcast industry secret. If you rate and review the show on iTunes, the more I Have At's discoverability will go up for people looking for beery tech podcasts on iTunes. It shows up as a recommended suggestion. And if I could just reach one more potential listening human brain out of an infinite number of human brains based on that iTunes suggestion, I consider that a win. And as always, you can also support the show directly with money. If you enjoy what you're hearing each episode, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. That $1 goes a long way and is deeply appreciated. I like it very much. Oh, mango. It was delicious, and it's all gone. I'm gonna get another can of that. I think it was a limited release. Well, that's for me to worry about, unless you want to track it down, too. I don't know. We'll compare notes. Anyway, that means it is time for me to go. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and the eyed creatures about the show, and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpanddeckel.com, or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!